BBC News at 3 o'clock. This is Adam Porter. Donald Trump has commuted the prison sentence of his longtime friend and former adviser Roger Stone, saying he was vulnerable to coronavirus in jail. Stone was convicted of lying to Congress, obstruction and witness tampering in relation to the investigation into Russian meddling in the 2016 presidential election. Our correspondent David Willis says it's not the first such intervention from Mr. Trump.
This president has proved that he's quite keen on commuting sentences. He did so with the former Illinois governor, Rob Blagojevich, earlier in the year. Ditto the former New York police chief, Bernard Kerik. So President Trump is not a man who is afraid to use those powers.
MPs have warned that the system of predicted grades, which is being used in place of exams in schools in England this summer, could deny pupils from disadvantaged and ethnic minority backgrounds the marks they deserve. The Commons Education Committee says the process of standardisation it involves could adversely affect improving schools. Labour is calling for the government to clarify its position on masks after the Prime Minister indicated he could make them mandatory in more confined spaces in England. Ministers have previously been sceptical about how effective they are as a means of preventing the spread of coronavirus. Here's Jessica Parker.
Pictures released last night showed Boris Johnson for the first time wearing a mask in public. That after he suggested it was time to be stricter on the issue of face coverings in confined spaces. Masks are already compulsory on public transport in England, and senior government sources confirmed that ministers are looking at whether to make them mandatory in shops as well, as is the case in Scotland. The government has, in the past, described the scientific evidence around wearing masks in public as weak. But yesterday, the Prime Minister said that the balance of scientific opinion seemed to have shifted.
Holiday accommodation in Wales without shared facilities can reopen today for the first time since March in a further easing of lockdown rules. Some in the tourist industry have complained about not being given enough warning about what regulations to follow. Clinos Jones, who runs Holiday Cottages in Manorbia in West Wales, says getting ready has been hard.
The process in order to open was massive. We needed to go into each cottage individually and they all needed to have their own risk assessments, and then there was so much to think about what we provide in the cottages, what's essential, what's not, how we're going to clean them. And then the added cost has just sort of spiralled.
The skeleton of a man believed to have been murdered or executed during the Iron Age has been found during HS2 archaeological works in Buckinghamshire. The exact cause of Welwick Farm man's demise is unknown, but the project archaeologist said there were not many ways you could end up in a ditch, face down, with your hands bound. BBC News, it's 3 minutes past three.
Welcome to The First Time with me, Matt Everett. This is the series where we meet some of the most influential and best-loved musicians around and look at the seminal first musical moments that shaped their lives and their careers. Sometimes the perfect band comes along at the perfect time. A group that captures a moment in your life so well that you'll always have a place in your heart for them. For anyone going to gigs or buying records during the 90s, I'd almost guarantee that my guest group featured heavily in your life. Five great albums, a list of pretty much flawless singles, all of which have aged much better than many of their 90s peers. My guest this week from Supergrass, and now a rather fine solo artist, is Gaz Coombs. Hey! Here Gaz talks about digging through his uncle's record box and how that led him to discover his first musical influences, his first band, the Jennifers, who had morphed into Supergrass and were only 15 years old when they got signed. He also looks back at Supergrass's massive breakthrough singles like Caught by the Fuzz and how he feels about All Right, the song that in many ways defined Supergrass's career. Also, he chats about what caused the band's breakup in 2010 and if that reunion is ever going to happen. But there's also his solo career to cover, bringing us up to date with his most recent album, the rather brilliant Matador. But I started by asking Gaz, as I do with all my guests, when was he first aware of music?
Oh, I think it would probably be, you know, family get-togethers, family gatherings, long, long time ago when I was a little kid. And I remember a few of my uncles would turn up with their guitars and someone would jump on the piano and there'd be kind of various things going on in amongst the chaos and mayhem and I imagine drinking. So I don't know, just sort of Eddie Cochran and stuff. My uncles would start playing some Elvis or Eddie Cochran. And so, I mean, Summertime Blues is a really early, early memory.
That's a good track to start off, huh?
Yeah. My uncle used to do impressions of, like, you know, Buddy Holly and Elvis. He had a bit of a quiff, so he'd sort of shake his quiff around, kind of playing these songs on acoustic. So that definitely had a bit of an impact, yeah.
Sometimes I wonder what I'm gonna do, but there ain't no cure for the summertime blues. Oh, well, my mom and papa told me, son, you gotta make some money. But if you wanna use the car to go a ride next Sunday. Oh, well, I didn't go to work, told the boss I was sick.
You can't use a car cause you didn't work or live.
Sometimes I wonder what I'm gonna do, but there ain't no cure for the summertime blues. I'm gonna take 2 weeks, gonna have a fine vacation. I'm gonna take my problem to the United Nations. Well, I called my congressman and he said, quote,
I'd like to help you, son, but you're too young to vote.
Sometimes I wonder what I'm gonna do, but there ain't no cure for the summertime blues.
And what about the first piece of music that you can remember being on, like, a record player or on the radio? Not that you owned yet, but the first thing you remember thinking, that's interesting, that sound coming out of there.
Yeah, I'm not sure. It was probably stuff coming from, you know, my older brother's bedrooms, you know, and you know, kind of hearing Pixies and stuff like that through the bedroom walls and Spaceman 3. And yeah, I was probably really sort of in pop mode, you know, at that time, and listening to stuff like Huey Lewis and the News. And well, it's probably just from watching Back to the Future.
That's the power of love. That's the power of love.
But, you know, do you know what I mean? All the kind of chart stuff being like six or seven or whatever. So hearing this other stuff coming out of my brother's rooms, I think was probably a bit of an eye-opener.
And there's always that thing with an elder sibling, it's like you kind of look up to them a little bit, and what they're into you want to get into, I suppose.
Yeah, no, totally. I think, you know, it's had a lot to do with, you know, some of the first records that I ended up buying, yeah.
What was the first record you bought?
Well, it was also kind of tricky, because I remember one of my uncles went travelling around the world when I must have been about 10 or 11, and he left just a whole load of vinyl in our basement, just kind of boxes and boxes of it. And I remember going down there one afternoon. I'd been told not to touch any of it or go near any of it by my mum.
Yeah. So obviously I'm going to go down there and touch all of it.
So I remember going down there and, just kind of started sort of going through the records and just popping the odd one on him. And there was kind of everything. There was, you know, Neil Young and Sex Pistols, Patti Smith and Blondie and J.J. Cale and, you know, the Stones and Hendrix, the Who, and I just spent hours going through all this amazing music. So yeah, I think that definitely was the moment, if you like, when I realised that there was more to music than the top 10 or the charts or whatever. Along with 1985 not being a particularly amazing year for music,
yeah.
So it was really a huge eye opener to see all this great these incredible artists and all these amazing albums. I think Hatful of Hollow was probably my first purchase by the Smiths. And then I went on to buy all of those 12 inches and 7 inches and 10 inches. And
what's the Smiths track we should play at this juncture?
I mean, This Charming Man was just one that immediately kind of grabbed me, you know, Hand in Glove as well. But you know, yeah, this Charming Man was just, you know, I guess at that age as well, it kind of helps having a kind of accessible pop element to that tune. But yeah, that kind of hit me pretty early.
The first song you learned to play the guitar on was Freak Scene by Dinosaur Jr., is that right?
Pretty much, yeah.
That's a very good song to start off with, isn't it?
Yeah, it was kind of easy. It was sort of, you know, and I just put distortion pedal on and just started playing the guitar. I mean, I wasn't very good either. And, you know, it was just a really simple rock and roll song. You know, I mean, I played piano for years, like before that, when I was a kind of small kid. So, you know, I think I realised that piano was probably not a particularly kind of sexy instrument to play on stage at that point. And I just thought, yeah, I got to go on guitar. I got to have a go.
Did you see yourself as kind of a Jay Maskis, kind of that sort of intense guitar walls of noise? Did you want to emulate that?
I don't know. I think it's just really natural to kind of turn everything up at that point. You know,
I can't play very well, but if I turn it loud, yeah, you can't tell.
Exactly. It sort of clouds it over, you know. And I mean, you know, I don't know if that was part of even our sound as a band when we formed Supergrass. You know, I mean, I think it's a lot to do with, you know, people always kind of make references of who they think we sound like and what they thought our kind of influences were. But I think a lot of it was just being in a small room in this little house. And also Danny playing so loud. His cymbals were just always so loud. So my amp had to go up. And then I guess Mick would feel left out and think, right, I've got to pump the bass up then. And so all of a sudden we're all just doing this manic kind of punk sound. And I think that's how it came about, rather than any specific influences. So
it was an arms race, basically.
I think it was, yeah, yeah. So that had a lot to do with those early songs that we learnt, I guess, and covered in our first band, and Freak Scene being one of them, yeah.
I've seen enough to eye you, but I've seen too much to try you. It's always weirdness why you dig it much too much to fry you. The weirdness flows between us, anyone can tell to see us. Freak scene just can't believe us, or can it just be cool and free us?
First gig that you went to?
First gig, it's a bit cloudy. I think when I first started going to shows, probably I was maybe 14, 15, sort of sneaking in. And, I mean, Ride was one of them, but I think probably the one I I remember most was in spiral carpets at the Jericho Tavern, which was just an amazing show. I went along with Danny, and we got to the front of the gig, and we were just going mental through the whole show. And Danny was going particularly nuts that night and just jumping around and going crazy. And Tom, the lead singer, just at one point just did a little kind of nod to Danny and was like, hey, this next one's for you, man. The little lad down the front going crazy. I spoke to Clint Boone about a year ago or something, and he remembers he kind of dedicated this song to Danny and that we were going nuts at the front, which I thought was kind of quite sweet. So, yeah, really memorable show, that one. And I think the wedding present wasn't too far after that as well, at the Jericho Tavern. So there was some crackers, you know, just that feeling and the heat and the sweat and the noise and, you know, it was just like nothing else, you know? And I still feel the same now. I still get that same buzz.
Because normally when I do this with artists, you say, oh, you know, first we have to talk about the first band, and there's, oh, it was this band called the Sparkplugs, and it was just me and my mates, and nothing ever happened. But your first band released your first single, and it kind of existed as a proper professional group,
outside of our bubble, yeah.
Yeah.
No, it was kind of weird.
I mean, how old were you when the Jennifers released the first single?
15, I think, yeah. That's the one. My mum had to kind of sign the contract after this little gig we did in Oxford, which is quite bizarre.
I mean, do you think that was a healthy thing because you didn't take it seriously, or do you think it was maybe just, you know, a little bit scary, it's a little bit intimidating putting a bunch of young lads in that position, giving them money and a record deal?
I don't know. I mean, it didn't change that quickly, you know. It wasn't a big thing, the first single deal with the Jennifers. I mean, we were sort of running around the country in the back of a transit van just doing little shows and getting ripped off by people, not getting paid and all that sort of stuff. And so the deal with Nude at the time was it seemed like a big thing. I mean, you know, it was Suede's label. Mm. But I don't know, it still felt like, you know, this is the sort of learning curve. I think we realised at the time that maybe it wasn't going to be a long-term thing, the Jennifers, and the transition into Supergrass seemed pretty kind of seamless, really, or quite a natural transition. Yeah, it was like our Jennifers was our YTS. So.
You're gonna have to try.
I mean, pretty much straight from the off, we caught by the Fuzz, 94, first Supergrass single. If Genovis had been your sort of YTS kicking about, not doing much work, all of a sudden you kick into another gear and it's the exposure and it's happening very, very quickly.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, we saw it straight away with the first couple of gigs that we did as Supergrass. I mean, I guess what was great about the Genovis was we'd gained a big fan base in Oxford.
Mm.
So, you know, the Genovis shows were all kind of sold. They were always sort of packed and sold out. So I guess when we moved it onto Supergrass, there was already a pretty good local fan base. So when we did a couple of shows, I guess really late 93, maybe early 94, it was just a whole heap of industry there, people from London and labels, and we could tell, you know, we knew on that night that it was a different feel in the room.
Something was happening.
Yeah, yeah. So that just really moved so fast. It just happened so quickly. And before we knew it, yeah, we were signing the contract on the MDs behind. Bend over. I think actually something like that.
Yeah.
It's just one of those stories that's got really clouded. But yeah, yeah. So then all of a sudden, yeah, we were just in EMI signing this hefty contract. So it was kind of quite nuts, really. It sort of, it just all kind of happened so quick.
You're listening to The First Time with me, Matt Everett, and my guest this week, Gaz Coombs. And that was quite obviously Caught by the Fuzz, Supergrass's very first single from way back in October 1994.
BBC Sounds.
Buffalo, buffalo, open arms, take me home.
I'm Matt Everett, and this is the first time where we look at the key first moments in an artist's career. And that song was Buffalo by my guest this week, Gaz Coombs. And one of the things I had to talk to Gaz about was Supergrass's first record in 1995.
From the minute the first album comes out, I Shoot Coco, you had such a recognisable image. There was almost a Dayglow easily recognisable image that went around the band. Was that something that you look back on with fondness, or do you think it kind of plagued us for a while, that cartoonish aspect of the band? I think listening to the work that you did straight from the off, I think maybe sometimes people forgot about the musical ambition and ability in the band because they sort of, oh, you're like that Monkees thing.
Yeah, but I guess you kind of always need that, really, as music fans and even the media to some degree. They need something to sort of attach to it, you know, visually, and something that can connect with kids and you know, I don't know. I don't think we really, we didn't have anything to do with it. We were just doing what we were doing. And in fact, when I look back at loads of old photos, it's just, some of the clothes that we wore were just unbelievable. You know, those moments I was wearing sort of like yellow flares. I looked like a sort of children's TV presenter. I don't know what I was thinking, but these really strange fashion decisions that we made. But I think that was all part of it. The fact that there was no sort of uniform look. And, yeah, we just kind of wear whatever we had. And Danny would often wear his big sort of purple velvet suit and with big flares. And I don't know, it was just kind of eccentric but a bit weird. And I don't know, it just seemed to connect. And maybe that we were so young as well, you know, baby faces. And I guess people love that sort of thing, you know.
Neil Young, you mentioned Neil Young before. When did you first fall in love with...
Probably those early, sort of leafing through all those records that my uncle sort of left in the basement, really. I guess it was just the songs at first, you know, and I think my introduction to Neil Young was actually Decade, which was like his kind of best of that he created. At the end, and I just the songs grabbed me straight away, I guess, and the diversity and the melodies, I think, was something that struck me immediately. And then as I got more into him, just his approach, you know, no compromising, you know, and it's about feel rather than technical perfection, or, you know, even the way that the albums were produced. It was about the room and what was happening. It was about the little bum notes or sort of quivering, sort of wavering vocal. And it was just all about all those kind of, I don't know. I don't know whether it's imperfections because it's all beautiful and it's kind of perfect. But do you know what I mean? The vulnerability of it.
It's capturing something.
Is what really, really grabbed me, yeah. And it's something that I always try and do if I'm recording, is to forget about nailing the performance and getting the sonic quality to a certain standard. It's more about the performance and about how it feels. And even if there's some hiss on it or a little bum note, it's not important.
What's the track we should play?
Southern Man, probably, was one of my early memories from listening to Decade and just hearing the sound of it and thinking, oh, my God, that just sounds insane. That's just all... It's glued together, this beautiful sound and the piano, so... Yeah.
Southern man, better keep your head. Don't forget what your good book says. Southern change's gonna come at last. Now your crosses are burning fast. Southern man.
Got to ask you about All Right, because we've got to, really, because if you're lucky enough... If you're lucky enough to have one of those songs in your career, I think you're a lucky musician. I mean, how do you feel about it? What's your relationship like with the track now?
It's like it's a bit like counselling, isn't it? Right, can I just sit back?
So tell me about the track.
I'm just going to sit back here a little bit. I'm going to get into this stuff, man. No, the thing about it is it's quite mad. I do feel blessed, and I'm sure the other guys do as well, is that, you know, I remember writing it. I remember when we wrote it together, just having a laugh, and we were just messing around, and even writing the lyrics, we wandered off to the local pub in Forest Hill, which is where Danny's folks were living, and just sitting around a pub table just writing these mad lyrics, and with just absolutely no thought that A, anyone would either listen to it, but B, it would ever have any success. So it's kind of nice to sort of hold on to that, I guess. You know, kind of regardless of what happened, because it's kind of, I guess it's the people's song now. You know, it's been taken over and
doesn't belong to you anymore.
You know, in a way, it's been sort of taken away from us. But I can always link it back to that moment. Yeah, I remember sitting at Danny's folks had this really dodgy old upright piano, and I remember just going over to it and playing the two chords in a kind of quite a relaxed way. And then just suddenly just being really silly and going, hey, look, Danny, watch this, and hammering them really hard, going, did, like I was in some Victorian sort of pub or something. I don't know, it's just weird, just kind of messing around, you know. And that was it, you know. So it's weird to think how these things are sort of conceived and how little you really think about it.
Elvis Presley, as a man who's, as you say, fond of a quiff, you know, he is the king. Was your love of Elvis something that was born out of the records you found in your uncle's chest, or has that developed? Because Elvis can come to you many times in your life for different reasons.
I think it sort of developed. I mean, definitely that early fascination as a kid. There's something kind of quite alien about Elvis, I think, when you kind of see him. And
he looked like he'd been beamed from another planet.
Yeah, just like created to sort of to be the king of rock and roll in every way. You know, visually and his voice. I genuinely think that his voice was the first thing that hit me. it's just incredible. Still nothing really compares to it. I mean, you know, you can enjoy Johnny Cash in a different way, you know, in his voice there is nothing that compares to Johnny Cash's voice, and it's, you know, I can appreciate the differences, but with Elvis there's something just so sort of warm and soothing about it as well. And then when I met my girlfriend years and years ago, she was just a massive Elvis fan. She had a poster on her wall when she was a kid. Like, this is like 5, 6, 7 years old, and she had to kind of kiss it every night before bed.
Oh.
A little bit weird, but, you know.
it yeah, depends where she's kissing the poster.
I'm
really
sure it's very innocent. But and so when I met her, we sort of bonded. I mean, we bonded over Elvis and Robert Smith, actually, which is kind of a strange pairing.
I'd like to see them on stage together.
But it's like, it's what you do, I guess. You know, when you meet someone, whoever it is, you kind of talk about music and what you love. And so that's where the Elvis thing came. And now, I mean, my house has got so many bits of Elvis all over the place. And so he's definitely had a big impact on our family, you know.
Have you guys got an Elvis song that we should play that's special for you two?
Oh, wow. Oh, let me think. Why don't we play Little Sister? We love it. We love that one.
Little sister, don't you? Little sister, don't you? Little sister, don't you kiss me once or twice and say it's very nice and then you run? Little sister, don't you do what your big sister done? Well, I dated your big sister and I took her to a show. I went for some candy, along came Jim Dandy and they snuck right out the door. Little sister, don't you? Little sister, don't you? Little sister, don't you kiss me once or twice and say it's very nice and then you run? Little sister, don't you do what your big sister done? Every time I see your sister, well, she's got somebody new. She's mean and she's evil like that little old moon evil. Guess I'll try my luck with you. Little sister, don't you? Little sister, don't you? Little sister, don't you kiss me once or twice and say it's very nice and then you run? Little sister, don't you do what your big sister done? Well, I used to pull your pigtails and pinch your turned up nose, but you've been a growing and baby it's been showing from your head down to your toes. Little sister, don't you? Little sister, don't you? Little sister, don't you kiss me once or twice and say it's very nice and then you run? Little sister, don't you do what your big sister done?
When was the first time that you thought with Supergrass, this is as far as we're going to go? Even if things are building for a while, there must have been a moment when that, like, okay, I think it's going to stop.
I don't know. I think it was very late on, you know. I think because I'm generally a pretty optimistic person, I think, and try and see the good in any situation. So I think up until quite close to the end, I was still hoping that things would work out, but you know,
why didn't they?
I don't know. It's just we're in the middle of that record that we were recording, and I just wasn't feeling right, you know. And I think there was a lot of disagreements about how we should approach the record, what, you know, we were all individually into at that point, and trying to match it up and get on the same page. And it just became frustrating, you know, and the sessions became quite frustrating, I think, for all of us. But you know, from my point of view, it just wasn't really firing, and it just felt really tough and quite hard work and not very rewarding. And I always remember that feeling I used to get when, you know, you'd record a new track, even if it was a demo, and I'd kind of race around to people's houses or drive over to see people and say, look, get in my car, listen to this. I've just done this mental track. I wasn't getting in any of those feelings, you know. It felt kind of wrong and a little bit weird. Yeah, you know, so it was time to to call it a day, you know, and it was the right thing to do, just to try something else and try and evolve and push on through.
Is it a door that's closed permanently?
I don't think it can be in terms of really love the guys, man, and I think we're sort of... You don't lose that overnight, like, how you feel about each other and what we went through together. So I don't think it can necessarily be closed, but... Ooh, it's a tricky one. It just has to be right. If anything happens, it has to be right. First off, I think you need to really miss a band. As the audience, as the fans, I think you need to have been enough time, I guess, for water under the bridge for us as a band, but also, yeah, just to create a bit of distance. It was only, what, 4 or 5 years ago that we split up, so, yeah, it's just not in my thinking at the moment at all about doing anything, and I think you'll have to ask me in 10 years, man. I'm gonna put a number on it. Try that. Try 10 years.
First solo album, Here Come the Bombs, 2012. Was it difficult to make because you were in a new headspace, or was it like a release of I Have Complete Freedom? Was it a breakup album?
I don't know. I guess it was. I know my head was still half coming out of Supergrass and like sort of half in this new place. You know, I was really. It was a time of transition. I didn't really plan to make a record, to be honest, when we split. And I think it was just when 3 or 4 tracks just came along quite quick, that's when it all kind of seemed real, like it was really happening. Mm. But, you know, yeah, I'm really, really proud of that record. I think it worked out really well. And I think inevitably it was going to be experimental and exploratory, you know, just through the nature of kind of feeling your way and working out. Spent so many years playing with the other guys and writing with the other guys that we were a collective single voice, if you know what I mean. So I was never particularly my voice. So it was interesting working out what I sound like. Like, I don't know, what am I? What do I do?
What are you, guys?
What do I sound like?
What do you sound like?
And that was kind of mad. Mad sort of journey just to sort of work it out. And I think maybe on this one, on Matador, it's just, it feels more comfortable with my own skin and had time to sort of work on what sort of lights my candle musically, you know. It was great, man. It was such a sort of exciting time, you know, just really kind of edge of the seat stuff and putting things down quick. And even mixing was just really quick because I just didn't want to overdo anything or, you know, hammer anything home too much. Just let it sort of be what it was.
And the final thing we do is we ask someone to pick the final song.
Let's play... Actually, there's an album I got into fairly recently by a mad psychedelic band called Goat. They're quite bonkers. Yeah, I just heard this track and absolutely loved it and just remember turning it up really loud in the kitchen and dancing around with the kids. They loved it too. It's Run To Your Mama by Goat.
That's the last song we'll play. It's good to speak to you, man. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thanks, man.
This is Radio 2 on the BBC Sounds app, on your smart speaker and on 88 to 91 FM.
BBC News at 4 o'clock. This is Adam Porter. MPs on the Education Committee have warned that pupils from less affluent and ethnic minority backgrounds could be disadvantaged by the lack of exams this summer. A system of predicted grades is being used instead. Rebecca Montacute from the educational charity The Sutton Trust agrees that some students may not get the results they deserve.
We all have underlying ideas about how certain groups will perform, what we expect of them. That is an inherent part of any system that relies on people making an assessment of somebody's ability. And we know teachers very often will underpredict poorer students and think that they will do worse than how they actually end up doing on exams.
President Trump has commuted the jail sentence of his friend and former adviser Roger Stone, saying he'd be vulnerable to coronavirus if he went to prison. Critics have accused Mr. Trump of undermining the rule of law. David Willis reports.
Roger Stone was found guilty of lying to Congress, witness tampering and obstructing a congressional investigation. He was set to report to prison by next Tuesday. The reprieve, which Donald Trump had long hinted at, is seen as a reflection of the president's own distaste for the investigation conducted by former special counsel Robert Mueller into allegations of Russian interference in the 2016 election. But it will alarm those who've been critical of the president's repeated attempts to intervene in the country's judicial system.
Boris Johnson has said a stricter approach to the use of face coverings is needed to help stop the spread of coronavirus. They're already mandatory in shops in Scotland, and ministers are considering whether to follow suit in England. They've previously been sceptical about how effective masks were. The Shadow Treasury Minister Wes Streeting says that whatever decision is taken, it must be clear.
I think the key thing, though, is clarity. It does seem to me that one of the problems with this crisis is that at the beginning, I thought we had very clear, very sharp messaging coming from government and health experts, and over time that's eroded. And I think clarity, consistency will give people confidence.
The United States has recorded almost 64,000 new coronavirus cases in the past 24 hours, according to Johns Hopkins University. 774 people have died. There's been a surge in new cases over the past few days, and experts fear deaths may spike in the weeks to come. A think tank says the government may have lost around £4.5 billion to fraud during the pandemic, with the furlough jobs scheme particularly vulnerable. The centre-right policy exchange says there should be a special unit to investigate it. Ministers say they use every tool to prevent and detect fraud. Open-air swimming pools can reopen today in the latest easing of the lockdown in England, along with open-air theatres. In Wales, self-contained holiday accommodation can reopen. The holiday company TUI is restarting flights to a number of Spanish resorts. BBC News, it's 3 minutes past four.